all as in the days of Noah. That night, evil struck as Porgy and his rival for the affections of Bess, his best beloved, engage in mortal combat, and Porgy struck the knife blade deep into the body of his villainous rival. Police whistles sounded. People rushed into the house. Catfish Row was never the same again. This, my friends, is a picture of our world. An evil shadow in the skies as jet planes climb the steep ascent of heaven with their loads of bombs. There's crisis after crisis in Cuba, in Vietnam, in India and Pakistan, crises everywhere, and we rush out and religious people, we say, phew, pray it away, go away. For the moment it goes away, but the shadow is still circling over us. It's going to take something more than simple piety to drive that shadow away. It's going to take the best thinking, the hardest working, the greatest sacrifice, the readiness to give up life itself for the cause of peace, as men dare to give up their lives on the battlefield. You and I are entrusted with this responsibility. Let us never be guilty of what has been called the awful silence of the decent. Let us remember rather what Norman Cousins has said. This is not a war of man against man. This is a war of man against God, in which man is being reduced to the level of the beast. I'm glad for the faith of Mr. Phipps, the abolitionist, more than 100 years ago, who said that one man could be a hinge if he spoke his deepest convictions. May God bless us all.
Dahlgren. We do have a last speaker, and he is someone who is known, well known, I suspect, to many of you by name, if not by face. And now we shall know him face to face and mind to mind, so to speak. He is Robert Parris, the Field Secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and former director of the Mississippi Summer Project during the year 1964. Mr. Parris.
There's a sign in what you call the fishbowl which says that American soldiers are committing war crimes in Vietnam. And it's caused a great deal of consternation on the campus. And just before I came, I was listening to some debates around that sign. And I read in your paper an account about that sign. And one thing that people were saying was that sign was an affront to an academic community because it offered an emotional argument. Now, I would like to say why I feel that that's a good sign and what that sign in fact does and the dimension of the discussion which it opens up. I think that that sign does not state a set of facts. And that's the power of the sign. Its power is that it states a theory. It states a theory about our country at this moment, and about the war and the nature of the war that we're conducting. It says to me, in effect, that the war is not simply a war, but a criminal war. And the theory is that, in fact, we are conducting a criminal war, and that the killings of civilians, the looting of villages, the mass deportations are, in fact, then, under that theory, not chance byproducts of what we would like to call a just war. Because, in fact, in any war, people must be killed, and there must be grime and goriness. But on the contrary, that all those things are part and parcel of a criminal war, and that you could have anticipated that, and that if we continue to fight, then that is in fact the only way in which we can fight. Now, I think it's very important for the moral dimension of this fight that we're in to be clearly discussed, and that if there was one single overriding fault with the teachings last year, it was that they were discussed and debated on the plane of political, economic, historical facts about Southeast Asia and the Cold War. And nobody could follow them. Nobody could hardly follow them. Ordinary people out in the streets couldn't follow the discussion. And I think the bulk of people in your universities couldn't follow the discussion, because we don't know anything about those facts. And furthermore, I don't believe that anyone has real access to information about them. So what you get always is one side trotting out this set of facts, and another side trotting out another set of facts, and then a very heated debate over whether, in fact, this is a fact or is not a fact. And then everybody gets lost. So that if the teachings were going to change in any direction in the coming year, it would seem to me that that sign sets a dimension for that change. And that, in fact, people take up the debate along the question of the theory that this country is currently operating on versus another theory, that we are, in fact, conducting a criminal war, that we're not conducting just plain war. Now, the religious community suffers from the fact that the last great war in which we participated was fought as a moral war by us. And Reinhold Niebuhr wrote out a theological argument for the just war. And it still carries. It still exists. It hasn't been contradicted or carried over into this new phase. And people in this country, and I believe most of the religious community in this country, are caught up in that trap and that concept of war just as much as we are all caught up in Dulles policies of the Cold War. And someone, unfortunately, Reinhold Niebuhr is very old and can't get about and can't review the new situation that we're in and come out with a new theological treatise underpinning a different kind of response to what's happening in Vietnam. But someone, it seems to me, will have to take up reconstructing or constructing a different theory and a different rationale to take on this country's concept of why it's fighting. I would like to give maybe, well, let me go back to the point about information and the question about theories. What I learned in the South, and in Mississippi particularly, was that the going social theory about their way of life and what threatened it was able to absorb or dismiss all contradicting facts. Some white person kills a Negro, and the people who live in that society don't absorb that as a fact. They interpret it and change it and make it simply fit their theory, or they dismiss it. And it seems to me that we know from science and from the histories of theories that theories, you know, that they're very resistant to facts which don't jive with their main premises. They dismiss them. They ignore them. Or they simply reinterpret them and put them in there as part of the argument. So I'm very skeptical of whether you will be able to reach people in this country with facts. It seems to me that if you're going to reach them at all, that you'll have to be bold enough to construct a different theory about this country and about the war we're fighting and our relationship to it. Now, one case in point. Life magazine had an article last week, I think, about a village in South Vietnam. And the essence of that article was to back up the theory, it seems to me, that the Viet Cong are terrorists, that the population is not really on their side, that the way in which they win over the population is by acts of terror, and in fact, it showed names of people who were village chiefs who were on a list of people to be assassinated. Now that argument presents, or that article proposes to present, you know, certain facts about something. Now, if you listen to the theory about revolutionary guerrilla warfare proposed by Ahmed earlier, and I'm not sure he said it in here, one thing I heard in the work study group was the whole process of preparing a village for political assassination. And Stan Bilei was making a distinction in our group between acts of terror and political assassination. And the distinction was whether or not the onlooking population was afraid and in fact fear-struck. If it was, then you were dealing with an act of terror. If it was not, then you were dealing with political assassination. Now, in the article, they talked about circulating the names of these people for killing. Now, under that theory, then, that becomes an educational process in the village in which the village is notified that random terror is not to take place, but certain people are to suffer political assassination. And in fact, it showed that those people were all moving and grouping together and living together outside of the village because of this. The other thing that interests me was that when they gave the history of those people subject to political assassination, it turned out that all of them, it seems to me, if not maybe one or two exceptions, fought with the French and against the move to throw out the French. Now, my point is simply that there you have information accessible to everyone in this country in Life magazine, which can be used one way or another. Life magazine and the government and the people in Time Life want to use it to support their going theory about the war. If you had another theory, you could treat it as a neutral set of facts and use it to support that other theory. Now, I think if we're going to reach through to lots of people in this country, then we will have to look for clues in the information that they already get. And that you will really have to learn and teach people in your classes how to read Newsweek, Time, Life, and their papers. Learn how to read them, one, to cull out of them the theories which are never explicitly stated, but which the argument, because we operate within a general frame of reference, supports. And present, if you can, or if you believe it, a different theory, which those same arguments and those same facts could also support. Because if we have to rely on expertise, and if we have to rely on people who have been to Vietnam, or on the people who know the specifics of the political and economic and historical situations, then we will get bogged down, it seems to me, time and time again. I have just one other dimension that I'd like to talk to, and that is to the question of action and what people have to do if they're to penetrate through to people in this country. And it seems to me from all of the proposals that I've heard around the country, that the one that has perhaps some chance of making a penetration is the one which involves people from all walks of life in this country going to Southeast Asia, I've heard it in the form of people going as hostages to Hanoi and to North Vietnam, people going in the form of work campus to build, rebuild bombed out areas in North or South Vietnam. I've heard it in the form of people going to China in defiance of this country and committing some form of civil disobedience, and in going to, after proper preparation, to in effect a recognition of Red China by people in this country. Now, it seems to me that all of those proposals have merit, and they might break through to some people in this country. It depends how they're handled, whether they can get widespread support and funding. And I would suppose that they would have to be initiated among students. Maybe the clergy might initiate one phase of that program. But I would suppose still that the cutting edge for change in this country is with the young people, and that they would have to take the initiation in such a project. And it may be that students on this campus might begin a discussion of that and see also if it can be picked up on other campuses. Otherwise, I myself don't see how you break through the myths. I just don't see what the forces are in the society. Nor do I accept the argument that what you can do with this and all you can do with this is educate people in this country, so when the next one comes around, there'll be a different response. Because it seems to me Morgenthau's argument in the New York Review that we don't know what this country will be like if in fact we win. I mean, if we gut out South Vietnam, is very powerful.
This announcement. Someone has seen fit to get out a paper entitled Statement of Principles of the Conference on Vietnam Steering Committee. Presumably that would purport to be the committee planning this conference, and has passed it out here just in case there is any confusion in your mind. The statement so headed is not the work of the conference committee, but of somebody else who evidently wished to, under the cloak of a lot of syllables and a closeness of name, pass off some opinions that are not necessarily, and indeed not definitely, those of the committee nor of the conference. This then closes the afternoon session. We commence tonight at 7:30 with a series of public speeches. Lord Fenner Brockway of the House of Lords of Great Britain, Makoto Oda, Japanese author, Mr. Emil Macy, United Automobile Workers, and Mr. Arthur Miller, playwright. Thank you.
Hello, 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 hey. Hey. Hello, hello, hello.
Sorry.
Hello, test one.